Welcome to Inside Education, the programme on 103.2 Dublin City FM dedicated to teachers, education researchers and policymakers, and everyone interested in teaching and learning. I'm Sean Delaney, and podcasts of almost 300 previous programmes are available on seandelaney.com/podcasts. On this week's programme, I bring you an interview with a distinguished educator who has substantial expertise and interest in professional development for teachers. Hilda Borko is an educational psychologist and a professor at Stanford University Graduate School of Education. Professor Borko is a former president of the American Educational Research Association. She conducts research into professional development for teachers in the areas of mathematics and science. I met up with Hilda Borko at the annual conference of the American Educational Research Association, which was held in San Antonio, Texas, earlier this year. She is currently studying a professional development institute where teachers doing a summer course get to implement their ideas with children other than those they usually work with. I began by asking Hilda to tell me more about this.
So we're working in a summer institute with teachers and had to find a summer school that was close by, that was willing to have a group of teachers come for a couple weeks out of like a six-week program and be there in the mornings. So it was a very much looking for a place that was willing to negotiate with us to have people try out some things they were just learning.
So these were children who were enrolled in a summer school, is that right?
So the practicum was based in, right, an elementary school where children were coming to summer school.
And how widespread are such summer schools for children in the United States?
A lot of it depends on how well public education is funded. Some summer schools will charge students. Some are available for free. Like, I have one colleague who has a foundation and she runs a summer school program for middle school students who are transitioning to high school, and she does it in high poverty, high-risk areas to help them have a better chance in high school. So that's something that's privately funded through donors. That's not so typical, I don't think. It's hard for me to answer that question. I know that in the area that we were working in on this particular project, there were a couple of summer school programs that were being run in some of the schools, and they were drawing from students from the area, not just from that school.
So what exactly did your teachers then, the teachers who were studying science education with you, what did they do when they went out into that practicum?
The focus of the project was on scientific discourse and argumentation. They were in a one-week summer institute where they learned some of the teacher moves to promote argumentation, teacher practices, what is meant in the next generation science standards by scientific argumentation. They worked on a particular unit of study that they were preparing to use in the fall. And then they went into the summer school classrooms and they worked in pairs usually in the morning to either work with small groups or work with the whole class and essentially try out the new practices that they had just learned. So teachers were making their own classrooms available for these other experienced teachers to come in and try out some new ideas, and they were videotaped. And then in the afternoon they came and worked with the professional development group in small groups to debrief, to reflect, to watch video of the summer school sessions and reflect on their practices, and then a little bit of planning time for the next day's work.
When you say scientific argumentation, what exactly did you want the teachers to do with the children to promote scientific argumentation, or what exactly does that look like in practice?
The model that we used was a model that had three basic broad practices by teachers, which were ask an open question that's going to get students to talk and to talk broadly about scientific issues, press, which is to push or encourage students to elaborate on their ideas, to provide evidence for their ideas, and then link, which is the teacher either linking students' ideas or asking students to link their ideas. And let's see if I can remember the student practices. So it was to explain an idea, to build on other students' thinking, and then the third level is to critique. And critique is to challenge or question another student's ideas with a reason for it. So not just to say, I disagree, but to say, I disagree and here's how I was thinking about it, or I disagree because.
And this would have been relatively new for some of the teachers, at least.
Absolutely. And the literature suggests that scientific discourse is not typical anyway in classrooms, and the idea of having students build on one another's ideas and challenge one another's ideas is probably the hardest for teachers to do. In particular, teachers encouraging students to critique seems to be the highest bar, the hardest practice to instantiate.
And are there particular science topics that you use in this?
No, we were really focused on the practices, so it's whatever topics were being taught in the schools. We had an interesting situation because the particular unit that the professional development team used in the summer was one that was their particular group at Lawrence Hall had worked on and had developed. The schools were using a different one. So some of the teachers were able to use the unit that they'd essentially planned when they went into their regular class, and some were not. But, I mean, I think overall the message is that we were focused on the practices, and they should be able to be used with any scientific content.
And would you say the same about the grade level, or what particular, were you working with a particular grade level?
We were working with grades 3 through 5. So upper elementary is what we would call it.
And how did the teachers find the practicum experience as part of their professional development?
So I think that's complicated. And as I was saying yesterday in the talk, we haven't fully analyzed the survey data yet. They seemed to feel like it helped prepare them for starting the year and starting to incorporate discourse, more discourse into their classrooms. They talked about feeling more confident in discourse practices. I think there was some frustration around the practicum itself. Just it's hard to walk into a classroom where you don't know the students, where you don't know the school. It's a context that they're not used to. And in that sense, it's much like student teaching that pre-service teachers do, except you're having experienced teachers go in just for 2 weeks in the summer. So it's even more constrained.
And another form of professional development that you're quite familiar with is video, and using video in professional development. Can you say a little bit about how you've used that, either at the moment or how you've done it in the past?
And actually, it's interesting because, so our team was the research team in the project we were just talking about. The professional development team was also using video. They used it quite differently than I do, so there's a lot of different ways to use video. The projects that I've worked on over the years in mathematics, we use video from the teacher's own classrooms. We use 3 to 5 minute clips focused either on specific instructional practices or specific student practices that we want to highlight in the professional development. So for example, one of the big foci in math these days is having students work on problems in small groups. And if we want teachers to start to understand what students are doing in small groups, how students are making sense of mathematics, we'll pick a 5 minute clip. For example, it might highlight 2 students engaged in challenging one another, or 1 student who seems to be off track and not understanding, and have the teachers in conversation about it. The instances of practices that we selected were done sort of collaboratively with the teachers. Like teachers would say, we really want to work on our questioning strategies, or we would suggest launching a task, or how do you wrap up a task at the end of a lesson or a series of lessons. So it was collaborative. We had some ideas about the kinds of things that are important when you're using small group work, and then we also listened to what they wanted. The next phase of the work, in some sense we're in phase 3 now, the second phase was us working in a school district to develop a model for preparing teacher leaders. So then we're working with a group of teacher leaders to prepare them to lead professional development in their schools using the same model. So then we work with the teacher leaders around the kinds of priorities in the school district and what the school district wants the teachers to be working on, and then we work with them to select the videos for that. And in this third phase, we're now working with another school district, now in California rather than when I was in Colorado. And for that, it's much more of a research practice partnership. So when we were negotiating initially with the district, they're just rolling out a new curriculum, a new task-based curriculum. And our project is centered around problem-solving cycles, so it's how do you teach with tasks. So this was a really nice fit for us. It also meant that we were working with their curriculum and we're working with their priorities for what classrooms should look like. So we worked within that model, within their priorities.
And when you pick a video clip to work with, mm-hmm. with teachers, how do you go about working on that clip with them?
So the problem-solving cycle is meant to be a cycle of at least three workshops. In the first workshop, the teachers work on a particular task, preparing how they're going to teach that task to their students, so really deeply exploring the mathematics about it. What are multiple solution strategies? What are the affordances of the different solution strategies? How might I present this task? How might I launch it for students? Then between the first workshop and the second, they teach the task in their classrooms. We get the video and we pick clips. And picking the clips is where we go back to what are the practices that we want to be working on. So we'll pick a 3 to 5 minute clip and we'll bring it back into the next professional development meeting and use it as a springboard for discussion around the practices.
Okay, so would you say watch the video as a group?
Yes.
And then does the teacher who is teaching in the clip, do they talk about it? Or, you know, do you have a particular format for the discussion of the video clip? Or is it just people say whatever they notice in it?
We have a specific way of planning for it. I think I'll say that. That involves what do we want the teachers to notice? What about this instance do we want them to notice? So, for example, we want them to notice, it might be a mathematical idea, like, what do students understand about this task? What are the differences between what the different students understand? It might also be something that's more about student practices, like are students engaged in explanation? What kinds of explanations are they giving? Are they building on one another's ideas? It might be one of the priorities in the district we're working with is agency, identity, and authority, which is a issue of access, who has access to the mathematical content. So then we would pick a video clip that had some interesting dynamics around agency, and we would develop a set of questions. So part of planning for the workshop is watching the video a lot of times.
About how many?
It depends. Time is always an issue. So for the teacher leaders, they don't have that much time. I've been known to watch a video clip 10 times because we're trying to think about, so how do I want to launch the discussion? How do I want to frame the discussion? What do I want to make sure they notice? And we talk about back pocket questions. So in the planning and the agenda for the meeting, we would have a launching question and then a list of back pocket questions.
There are questions that you'll use if...
That you draw out of your back pocket to make sure that you're guiding the conversation in a way that's going to help people see the kinds of things that you've decided are important to see given the practices that you're working on.
And what kind of video clips tend to work best generating the kind of discussion you want to see in these sessions?
One of my colleagues, Miriam Sheeran, has written an article about that, and she lays out some criteria for what they've found. Part of it is there's a lot of different kinds of video clips that can make for rich conversations. And the kind of clip that you show has to do with sort of in part where the community is in terms of its development. So some video clips may show students struggling. Some video clips may show teachers coming up to a group and maybe not doing what some people think is ideal. And so is there enough trust in the community to talk about these practices in an environment that's both safe and challenging? And that develops over time.
I can imagine. And speaking of safe and challenging, are there difficulties getting permission from parents to allow video recording in the classrooms?
Yes. That's an easy one to answer. And so what we do in those situations is we ask the teachers when they're configuring their small groups to put students for whom we don't have permission in separate groups so that we make sure when we're video recording the groups we're only video recording students with whom we have permission. Yeah.
And are there any pitfalls you've come across in using video in professional development?
So when we're working with the teacher leaders and trying to help them prepare to run this kind of professional development, time is a factor. So it takes a fair amount of time to watch video, pick a clip, and prepare to lead a discussion about it. And we're currently working with teacher leaders from 6 schools, and we have a day with them in what we call a leader preparation meeting. We model a video-based discussion. We talk about the video-based discussion. I often am the one who debriefs the people who are leading the video-based discussion so that we can make visible the kinds of thinking that they did, both during the discussion and planning the discussion. And then that typically would be a good portion of the morning. And then in the afternoon, we work with the teacher leaders to help them pick clips and prepare. And it's very time consuming. And what we know is most of them don't have any kind of release time for this position that they have. So any time that they spend after the one day is their own time. Okay. So that's hard. Quality can be an issue. Although I have to say, you know, the first project we did, which was now 15 years ago, that was much more of an issue. Now we have this incredibly elaborate system for collecting video in classrooms where we go in with one camera, 4 iPads, one at each of the tables, and one audio recorder in addition to the iPad, because the audio recorder will have better sound. That makes the quality of the video not so much of a problem. It makes the task of choosing much harder, because now what you have is 4 small groups.
You've done all kinds of research in your career to date. What work are you most proud of?
I think I would say the work that we're doing now and the work that we've been doing working with districts, just because for right now where I am in my professional life, this kind of partnership with districts and trying to make a difference, actually doing the work with people and studying the process, is where I want to be. So it's exciting, it's challenging, it's messy, it's really messy, and I'm really proud's a funny word, but I guess I'm proud to be part of a group that's doing that.
We've spoken a lot about the work you've done with video and with practicums in professional development, but if you take a broader look at professional development of teachers, what are the key ingredients that need to go into professional development for teachers?
So I'm going to step back and say, if you ask me what conceptual work am I most proud of or think has had the most impact, it's been the work that I did around teacher learning. And what are the elements of programs that can facilitate teacher learning, what needs to be in place. So I like the question you just asked. I don't think we know the answer to that completely. So there's been some studies that talk about what are the essential elements of professional development. And I think, as Suzanne Wilson pointed out in our meeting yesterday, those are all structural. They're not about the content. And they're important, they're necessary but not sufficient, and what's missing is, what do you actually do with teachers? What are the mechanisms of teacher learning? I think the mechanisms question is a hard question to answer. I think we can say things like it has to be situated in their practice, that somehow the practice has to be part of the professional development. That doesn't mean it has to be conducted in their classrooms. It means you have to bring their classrooms and the issues from their classrooms into the professional development. That's where video comes in. It's a really powerful tool. Bringing in student work is another powerful tool. So one issue is bringing their practice into the professional development, and another big one is the idea of community and trust. So I think professional development is more effective when it's a group of people working collaboratively. And two important...
Do they have to be colleagues?
They don't have to be colleagues. It's easier in some ways if they're colleagues, because then they can bring it back to their schools more easily, and they have a support group in their schools in addition to the work that they're doing in the professional development context. But it doesn't have to be. I mean, I think this is where you have to go with what's realistic and what's available and what trade-offs are there. And the community is important because people have to trust and they have to be willing to challenge. So with video, you don't just want to use video of exemplars. We think it's more powerful to use video from teachers' own classrooms. I think we don't have research to argue for either video of your own classroom or video other classrooms. But I think that it's really important to not have just exemplars, but to have examples of, here's a situation that unfolds in a classroom. What's going on here? How do you make sense of it? What might a teacher do as a next step for people to bring their own video into professional development? They have to trust that it's going to be used in a way that's productive and sensitive.
Yeah, that is a dilemma, isn't it? Especially if you're using examples that are not exemplars or that are not exemplary, because there's going to be flaws in them, or there's going to be things that somebody mightn't necessarily be proud of, and then you don't necessarily want to be really super critical of them.
So we talk about that in a couple of ways. I mean, one of the things is we've learned over the years that in terms of building trust within a community, it works better to start with video of students, and often the teacher's not present at all, so it's students working in small groups. Another thing is you can bring in video of more problematic situations after the group has been working together for a while. It usually doesn't work to start with that. And the third one is we're very careful not to talk about teachers and students. We talk about teaching and learning. We have a set of video norms that we remind people of each time. And one of the norms is it's about teaching, not teachers. And that really helps to frame it.
I suppose the other challenge in professional development for teachers is that we always talk a lot about children learning in different ways, and teachers must learn in different ways as well. And that's another layer that makes it really difficult to talk about the kind of professional development that works for teachers. Isn't that right?
Yes, yes. And in different ways, and they're at different levels. We find that, again, if you move it up a level, our teacher leaders are at very different levels. So they have different levels of experience and skill, both in terms of teaching and in terms of being leaders. And in the particular district we're working with, some of them are much closer to the district ideal for what classrooms should look like, and some of them are much further away. And they work in really different contexts. You know, this district is one that's very mixed in terms of socioeconomic status, ethnicity, whether a school has English learners or not. So some of our schools are like 80% English learners, and some of them are 5% English learners. So the way you work with math is different, right?
And the teachers are at different stages of their career.
Right.
How did you come to choose a career in education?
That shouldn't be so hard of a question, right? I started out as an undergrad with a major in psychology and mathematics. I went ahead and got a teaching credential in some ways because that's what you do. And my mom was a teacher, and my dad was a university professor, so teaching was sort of in the family. And it's certification in special education with special needs students. And then I had to make a decision about graduate school. And I actually had two completely separate graduate programs that I paid for. Nice. You know, that I paid the initial fees because I hadn't quite decided. One of them was a program in counseling psychology, and the other was a program in education. And part of why I picked the program in education was this was a time of radical school reform and experiential ed, and the people that I would have worked with and did work with were very much committed to that. And I decided that's what I wanted to do. And we actually, when I was in graduate school, started a school. And we had a school modeled after Summerhill that we ran for 4 years.
So when you say started a school, you literally mean started an elementary school?
A middle school, high school. We literally started a school. We started a storefront school.
So what did that involve?
A lot of work.
Can you be more specific? I mean, getting a premises, even?
The first year we were in a church. The second year we were in a synagogue. I may have those backwards. And then the last 2 years we were literally in a storefront. And then that storefront is now a Dianetics operation.
And how did you fund it?
It was a tuition-based school with a sliding scale. I would say there were three ways we funded it. One is tuition-based sliding scale. The second is because a couple of us had special ed backgrounds and degrees, we helped the parents write for state funding for their students, because we had a number of students who qualified for state funding. And the third is that three of us were graduate students with research assistantships, so we didn't draw, essentially we didn't draw salaries. Okay. Or we drew what were not really a couple hundred dollars a month.
And why did you see the need to found your own school?
I'm not sure need is the right word. We wanted to try out these ideas. We were intrigued by them. We were passionate about them. And we wanted to try them out in practice.
Most people would do that by becoming teachers rather than setting up their own school.
There's a lot of constraints working within the system. I mean, that was one of the questions, because three of us had teaching certification. Three people didn't, although two of them were in a PhD program in education. And we wanted to be able to really push the boundaries. We did a lot of work outside of the building. We could set our own schedule. We did apply for state certification for the school. We didn't want to give grades. We wanted to be able to have much more flexibility in the courses that we taught and the way we taught them.
It sounds an amazing thing to do.
And it was in an era where that was more common. So there were a number of schools that came up in this, what's called, I guess, the radical school reform era, the era of the 70s.
And did you just close it then after the 4 years?
We did. It was a school that was our dream. And when we were ready to move on, we were successful in bringing a couple of other teachers involved, but they were also ready to move on at one point. The average life of a school, at least in the Los Angeles area where I was, this kind of private school, was 18 months. And so we lasted 4 years and could have kept going. We were ready to move on.
What a rich experience establishing a school must have been for someone who was to become a prominent educational researcher. That was Professor Hilda Borko bringing this week's Inside Education to a close. The interview was recorded at the 2017 annual meeting of the American Educational Research Association. If you'd like to listen back to this or almost 300 previous programmes, you can go to seandelaney.com/podcasts. My book about teaching is called Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have. And you can ask to borrow it at your local library, or you can purchase it online. Until the same time next week, it's goodbye from me, Sean Delaney. Have a great week.